All right, we're up to Zechariah 11. This is the 17th part of dealing with the prophets of the restoration. We're going to do the whole chapter. In chapter 10, we went over chapters 9 and 10. We were talking about, first of all, the Maccabees and all of the things really that are going on between the time of Zechariah and the rebuilding of the Second Temple and the time of the coming of Christ. And as we move into chapter 11, we're going to see first the things that immediately precede the coming of Christ, and then we're going to see a number of things that arise in conjunction with the coming of Christ. And among other things, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about verse 12, they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver, which is quoted in Matthew's Gospel as coming from Jeremiah. So we're going to address that head on. It's an important point, and one that I think you should be aware of, at least to some degree, because it's one of these things that people throw out and say, oh, well, look, you know, the Bible made a mistake. I'm showing you the Bible did make a mistake, and Matthew knew exactly what he was doing. In chapter 11, we're going to talk then about the period of time immediately prior to Messiah, and really all of the events surrounding the rejection of Messiah by Israel and the outcome of that. We've seen in these other chapters in Zechariah, a couple of times it's been alluded to, that Israel is going to be dispersed, that they're going to be cut off. There's going to come a time when they're going to be thrown out to the four winds, and we're going to get to that here. We're going to see really where that kind of fits in. This chapter then is going to give us a very close look at the messianic mission and its outcome for Israel. And we'll see in the next chapter things that have to do with the restoration of Israel. And in fact, the rest of the book is going to move in some sense beyond. Now, this is the importance of this, I think, is that we need to keep in mind that what happens prior to the millennium with respect to the Jews is in some sense, their regathering, reconstituting, is in some sense going to reflect what happens with Messiah when he comes. What the stuff preceding that, particularly the time of the Maccabees, and they're being brought back to the faith and sort of tied in to a course of obedience for a time leading up to the first advent. There's some language we're going to see that I think is going to point to a similar kind of thing. As I've been trying to point out, history has a way of repeating itself to some degree. And these prophecies have this form that they take where you've got a type and an antitype, and you've got a fulfillment that's sort of partial and then a more full fulfillment. And there are divisions of time in between. And so we have to keep in mind, and this is going to be important to understanding why Matthew quotes Zechariah the way he does. It's important to see that on this prophetic horizon, for example, all of the judgments of Israel appear at one peak looking across, which is why Matthew can line them all up together in Matthew 24 and 25. All of the judgments of God, under one consideration, are just judgments of God. Whether it's you personally, it's Israel as a nation, or it's all the nations of the earth. The judgment of God is, in some respect, just that. It's judgment. So these prophetic horizons are horizons that we have to recognize. And when it comes into the gathering of the Jews, reconstituting them under the Maccabees, there are things that we can learn from that with regard to the regathering of the Jews and their constitution of a nation prior to the millennium. You know, the one is before the first advent, the other before the second advent. And so there are some lessons, there are going to be some similarities. Part of the similarity with the Maccabees is that they throw off all their oppressors, right? They become independent again. They've removed themselves from idolatry. They find themselves freed of the outward meddling. And they're walking, at least somewhat, in a faithful manner. It's going to be like that prior to the millennium. There are other things that we could look at along the way and see parallels. Because again, every restoration to some extent is like every other restoration. Right? So there is a little bit of this cyclical or idealist or recapitulation that certain amillennialist idealists want to talk about. That idea is there, but there's also a real movement in history going on in the prophecy. And so while there are these things, and we should be thinking about them, one of the things that I think is so impressive here about what's going on in Zechariah is it's showing not only some of these cyclical moments where we have that prophetic horizon lining up, but it's showing the reality of history. They're showing a progression of history. And that's what we're going to see here now as we get into chapter 11. So I want to begin with verse 1.
Zechariah 11, verse 1. Open thy doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour thy cedars.
Yeah, this is interesting what's going on here, right? Through the prophet, God has, up until this point, he's encouraged the people to build the temple. He's been encouraging them. And this is really part of that encouragement too, but it's taking a little bit different turn, right? The temple, they knew, was going to be preserved. It would last until the time of the Messiah. There are a lot of comfortable promises that Zechariah gives to those who are rebuilding in his day. He's giving them hope in the future. That's a big part of the theme. So if the previous two chapters outline the time between the rebuilding of the temple and the coming of the Messiah, we should understand that they're foretelling the glory of the Maccabean deliverance, and they look beyond, as I said, to the... They're looking beyond the present, their present, to a future regathering of the Jews sometime prior to the millennium. So all of this goes to this point that rebuilding the temple is not in vain. But rebuilding the temple is necessary for the coming of the Messiah. The coming of the Messiah is necessary for that second coming, which will be preceded by the regathering of the Jews. Now, the first few verses in this chapter begin by rehearsing a calamity that's going to befall the Jewish nation just prior to the first advent of the Messiah. Many of the commentators, and when I say many, I mean almost all of them, including the Jewish commentators, see this as a description of the sacking of Jerusalem and the burning of the temple by the Romans in 70 AD. The first couple of verses. However, Calvin does not, and there are some people who follow Calvin in this, and I think Calvin is right on this point, not to restrict it. The judgment upon the unbelief of the Jews actually begins prior to the coming of the Messiah. The destruction of Jerusalem and of the temple is actually the completion of this prediction. All right, so do these first verses encompass that idea legitimately? Yes. Are they restricted to that period of time? Absolutely not. Because already things had started to change, and in fact there's some interesting things here in these first few verses. I don't think you can make the kind of sense out of them that you have if you understand that there is also this historical continuity going on. That we don't want to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem before the coming of the Messiah, right? So it's a prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem with the idea of the wasting of the land and the rejection of the Jews as a church and a nation for many generations. That's what's going on in these first few verses, clearly. But that begins prior to the Messiah. The coming of Messiah actually places the Jews in an interesting position. They're in the midst of judgment, in other words, when Messiah comes to them. This is a crossroads. They can make of it something good, that is, they can believe, or the judgment is going to follow through and have its full effect. Now, the prophet, and this is where, you know, the people look at the temple and all of that, they say, well, Lebanon is mentioned here because the temple is constructed out of the cedars of Lebanon, right? Well, that's clever and cute. Of course, I wonder what they're going to do, and they don't really have an answer when we get to verse 2, when we start talking about the oaks of Bashan. Because they weren't used in the building of the temple. So while the interpreters, I think, are right as to the full outcome of this prediction, they're wrong in their timeline. And this is a problem when you are simply looking at the idealist point of view, when you're not understanding that prophecy is historicist in its tendency. There are these cyclical, idealistic moments, right, where the peaks of prophecy hit one another and you have that prophetic horizon. But they're not all the same peaks, even though it's all the same judgment. Or the prophet is looking to the northwest, to Lebanon. And Lebanon was a portion of land bordering the Promised Land. And very clearly, as I say, it was a land renowned for cedars. We read about that all the time in the Bible, the cedars of Lebanon, right? It's actually a very interesting place because at this time it was secluded in such a way that it actually seemed like it was in a kind of forest. This is in the middle of a thick, it is in the middle of a forest. It's like it's in a fortress. It's in the middle of a thick forest. So it has this situation that makes it seem like an impregnable fortress. In fact, it was so, as military targets go, it was so not ideal, a military target, that the Jews thought it would remain free from hostile attack. But, you see, this verse is telling us that's not the case. As the Maccabean era comes to its conclusion, it turns out the Roman forces invade. And in 64 BC, the Roman general Pompey seizes Lebanon for the Roman Empire. Now, why is that important? What that signified was the end of, remember Daniel's four kingdoms. The third kingdom was the Greek, and it divided after the death of Alexander into four sub-kingdoms run by four generals. Lebanon was under the Seleucid power. When Pompey takes over, Roman power, that fourth kingdom, has come in over this part of the empire.
And
so it ends, it ends Greek power in that region.
So that's the last part of the Greek.
That's the last part of the Greek in that region. Right? But look at verse 2.
Verse 2. Howl, fir tree, for the cedar is fallen, because the mighty are spoiled. Howl, O ye oaks of Bashan, for the forest of the vintage has come down.
All right, so this is important, because what it's telling us is the Roman invasion doesn't stop there in Lebanon. To the northeast, there was a place that in the Bible is called Bashan. And it was noted for its trees, in this case, oak. At nearly the same time that the Romans invade Lebanon, they invade Bashan, or what we would call Syria. And this, too, is under the command of Pompey in 64 BC. And that marks the end of the reign of the Seleucid or Greek power that was in this region all the way, if you can imagine sort of a domed region over the Promised Land now, it's all Roman. 64 is the year that it changes from being Greek. The Greek Empire is up there. Now the Romans are there. Right? So it ends that. And in fact, from this region, Bashan, or Syria, in this portion of Syria, later in 66 to 70 A.D., around the time of the destruction of the temple, the Romans are actually going to start pulling troops out of this area and bring them in to Palestine to help put down the Jewish rebellion, which is going to end in the destruction of the temple. Now, the last phrase here, for the forest of the vintage has come down, that's referring back to Lebanon. The word vintage means the fortified or the inaccessible forest. And so again, by 64 BC, what has happened is both of these regions now have fallen firmly under the dominion of the Roman Empire. Now this is very important for what's coming. If you've ever wondered about some of the history, where it picks up in the New Testament, it's being prophesied right here. And we know names, and we know places, and we know dates now that the prophet doesn't reveal. All right, look at verse 3.
Zechariah 11, verse 3. There is a voice of the howling of the shepherds, for their glory is spoiled, a voice of the roaring of young lions, for the pride of Jordan is spoiled.
Okay, so what happens is this. In 63 B.C., which, since we're going B.C., 63 is after 64. It's the other way around with A.D. We're counting down toward Christ, right? We're not counting up. Pompey moves out of these two regions toward Judea. And what drew him in was an opportunity that presented itself that had been developing over the previous couple of years. And it's alluded to here in this verse. The howling of the shepherds, for their glory is spoiled, the voice of the roaring of young lions. In 67 B.C., the Jewish queen in Judea, her name was Salome Alexandra, died. And she died leaving two sons, princes, who were heirs apparent to the throne. But there doesn't seem to have been a great determination made. And even if there had been, it wouldn't have done any good because the princes One was named Hyrcanus the second, and the other is Aristobulus the second. They enter into conflict that end up, that their conflict, the two young lions, right? They're the pride, there they are, the pride of Jordan, the howling of the shepherds, the rulers of the people, and we'll see that they're also involved in the shepherds. They're involved in this civil war. Certainly serious civil unrest. Now, the Pharisees side with Hyrcanus. The Sadducees side with Aristobulus. So by the time we get to the time of Jesus, this has already been an ongoing conflict for some time between Pharisees and Sadducees. It starts now. It starts, and this conflict is actually what brings the Romans into Judea. The Romans actually come and restore peace, as we'll see. During Passover in 63 BC, Aristobulus and the Sadducees are in the temple celebrating, and they're besieged by Hyrcanus, and he has an ally, a guy named Aretas of Petra, who's helping him with this. Now that, another power outside of the Maccabean house, that could be strengthening things from a Roman geopolitical perspective. Aristobulus and the Sadducees appeal to Pompey for help. They invite him in, which is all the Romans really wanted, was an invite. Right, they would be more than happy. And because of this, Aristobulus and the Sadducees, at first, they're favored by the Romans. But what ends up happening is this. When the Romans come in, they want to go off to that temple and they want to look around. And the Sadducees resist them. They don't like the Roman presence in the temple. And as a result of them resisting, the Sadducees end up falling into disfavor with the Romans very quickly. When Pompey arrives, he actually goes into the temple and even into the holiest place, the Holy of Holies, where he is said to have beheld all of the sacred items that belonged to the temple that the Jews had, all the gold and silver vessels and all of the things that you read about in the Pentateuch. Of course, that defiles the temple, but Pompey, after he leaves, he commands the temple to be cleansed, and guess what he does? He appoints Hyrcanus to be the high priest. This is how the Pharisees come to be the people in power in Jesus' day. The Romans put them there. And this is why there are Herodians who are sort of supporting the status quo in the New Testament. This is why the Sadducees are always picking at the Pharisees. You know, they've got a beef that goes back a century.
So the Pharisees were pretty much traitors then, if they just let a foreign power in.
The Sadducees invited them in.
The Sadducees.
And then they turned on them. And the Pharisees ended up profiting from it. And probably to a lot of the people looked like the good guys in the end. Because they weren't the ones who compromised. The Sadducees compromised and let him in. You know, all they did is they went and picked up the pieces and managed to somehow maintain this friendly relation with the Roman Empire in the wake of that. Right? So when Pompey is now defeated, Pompey's defeated by somebody you probably heard of, Julius Caesar. Pompey gets defeated during the Roman Civil Wars in 48 BC. But Caesar, when he goes into Palestine, to Judea, Caesar decides he's going to work with Hyrcanus. And so the Pharisees remain in power. And it's at this time that something very interesting happens. Caesar takes a courtier of Hyrcanus, a guy named Antipater, or Herod the Great, and he makes him the civil ruler. He chooses him to be the civil ruler. Now, this is the Herod who is king at the time of the birth of Christ. He's an old man. Remember, he dies right after Jesus is born while he's in Egypt. But he's the guy who tries to have all the children killed. He's put in power by Julius Caesar. When Herod the Great dies in 4 BC, that's about when we think he dies, which is why we think the calendar is probably messed up a little bit, because we know that Jesus was born before he dies. So there's some slip in the calendar a little bit. The kingdom is divided among his sons. Herod Antipas takes Galilee. Philip the Tetrarch takes Golan in the northeast, and you read about him in the Bible. You read about all these guys. And then there's Archelaus, who became the ethnarch or national leader of Samaria and Judea. When they return for the taxing, they're going up in the days of Archelaus, right? Herod Antipas. Now, the Pride of Jordan here actually refers to the shrubbery that grew along the banks of the Jordan, where a lot of wild animals found shelter. So this is typological language that's being used that would have been known and understood. Ultimately, the Jewish feuding is what brought an end to their independence for several hundred years. They're fighting among themselves. But as I said, in the time of Herod, that's when Messiah is going to come. So this is not simply talking about the time at the after Messiah when the destruction of the temple occurs. This is the beginning of the judgment, because they're fighting among themselves. The Jews can't get it together. All right, look at verse 4.
Zechariah 11, verse 4. Thus saith the Lord my God, feed the flock of the slaughter.
Yeah, in verse 4, the Lord my God, Christ, he's speaking to the prophet, and he calls upon him to foretell through representing to the Jews using external types. We're going to see he picks up in verse 15. He picks up the instruments of a foolish shepherd. Right? He does these things that prophets do, where he's sort of dramatically impersonating something typically to make them understand what's going to happen, what's coming. That's what he's telling them to do. Feed the flock of the slaughter. So he begins by calling them the flock of the slaughter, which is a reference that is actually looking forward now to the consequence of the rejection of Messiah. In 70 AD, it's around 70 AD, the Jewish Rebellion, it's estimated that somewhere in the range of 1.5 million Jews are killed. There are a lot of Jews killed. It's a regular Holocaust. Nonetheless, this should also make us see that God is always acting the part of a shepherd to his people in their obedience and in their disobedience, because he's dealing with them as a people with whom he is in covenant. So this is the part that Zechariah has to play now. And it's interesting, because really at this point, what he's doing is he's about to set up this dramatic representation of where the Jews are going to find themselves at this point in history. It's during the days of Herod Messiah comes, and they're poised, they're actually in the middle of a judgment. And there's this time out now being called for Messiah to come. And this is sort of like those cases that from time to time you run into if you read in history, church history, or in the history of nations, where someone's about to be executed, and the person who has the power to execute pauses and says, if you'll just renounce whatever and swear allegiance, I won't put you to death. The Jews are about to be put in that position with the coming of Messiah. Right? This is a telling point for them. This is really it for them. You know, they could escape the judgment. They could escape the final destruction that's set before them. All they need to do is receive the Messiah. So the fact that all these things have just happened leading up to the time of the coming of Christ, they should have known. You know, there were people who were alive in Jesus' day. People who would remember, their grandparents would have remembered the glory of the Maccabeans. People who would have known something of how Herod came to power. This is all really within living memory for them. And if we understand the prophecy is actually pretty clear as to when Messiah is going to come. You know, when this fourth kingdom moves in, which they don't know is the Romans, but they should know at this point that it's the Greeks are there in Lebanon and Bashan. When the next power moves in to take over, it's at that time that Messiah is going to come. That's the point here. So they're not without warning. They're being given warnings again and again. And now they're being told, in essence, you know, I've set before you life and death. Choose you this day whom you will serve. Now, the situation is before you again. All right, look at verse 5.
Zechariah 11, verse 5. Whose possessor slay them and hold themselves not guilty, and they that sell them say, blessed be the Lord, for I am rich, and their own shepherds pity them not.
Yeah, and here, at the time that Zechariah is impersonating, if you will, the Messiah to come, we're being told whose possessors slay them. The possessors are the Romans. They hold themselves not guilty. Why? Well, because the Jews reject Christ, they're not going to be held guilty for their oppression. Right? It's often the case that those who oppress the covenant people are treated guilty by God. But in this case, the fact is, the sins of the people are such that these oppressions are actually taking the contours of righteous punishments inflicted. So they buy them, they possess them, they sell them, and say, blessed be the Lord, for I'm rich. That's the way the Romans were. They bought and sold the Jews like every other conquered people for their own gain. Now, when the Romans were in power, they ruled the roost. They would let no contrary force be raised against them, no contrary opinion raised. They actually allowed a lot of liberty. You know, it's sort of like the United States. You can do all kinds of things, but with ever increasing time, and as the empire grows more paranoid, they become less and less tolerant of speaking against the empire. You could do most anything. You worship how you like them, you know, under the Romans. But don't speak against the Roman government. Don't call into question anything that the Romans have made a matter of official policy. Because if you do that, you're going to be in trouble. That's what they do. They buy and sell people. They're trafficking in human lives. And they're getting rich on it. And the Romans knew how to conduct a good culture war when they needed one. Meanwhile, back in Judea, the shepherds, the civil and ecclesiastical rulers among the Jews, they're not really concerned about the Jewish problem. They're concerned about lining their own pockets now. You know, they're seeking their own interests. They have little regard for the people. Their own shepherds pity them not. Look at verse 6.
For I will have more pity than the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord. But lo, I will deliver the men, every one, into his neighbor's hand and into the hand of his king. And they shall smite the land, and out of their hand I will not deliver them.
Yeah, I will no more pity the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord. But lo, I'm going to deliver the men, everyone, into his neighbor's hand and into the hand of the king. So when the time comes, basically when the Jews, remember that imagery that was used early on of the bushel basket being filled. You know, when they finally filled up the cup of the Lord's wrath, then they're no longer going to be upheld. Right? The coming of Messiah is one last effort to save them. This is it. They either have to repent at the coming and calling of Christ, or the idea here is they're going to face the punishment of the Roman sword. And it's followed by a description of what's going to follow upon their impenitence. Right? I will no more pity the inhabitant of the land. This is last call. And if you don't heed it, what does he say? There's going to be civil war. He's going to deliver the men, everyone, into his neighbor's hand. There's going to be all kinds of fighting among themselves. Right? Which, by the way, is exactly what happens prior to the Romans putting down the Jewish rebellion right around 70 AD when the temple's destroyed. But in addition, they're going to be given into the hand of the king. Remember what they said at the crucifixion? We have no king but Caesar. That's their confession. And here they're told, if they don't accept the Messiah, they're going to be given over not only to their own internal dissensions and divisions and fightings and all of that, but they're also going to be turned over to the Romans. So we're going to, in the end, they're going to destroy the land of the Jews, and there's not going to be any escaping that destruction when it comes.
Yeah, never mind. That's exactly what I was going to ask. So they're calling Rome their...
We have their king. They did not accept the king of the Jews. We have no king but Caesar. It goes right along with this prophecy. You know, they don't stop and think what they're doing here. Verse 7.
Verse 7. And I will feed the flock of slaughter, even you, O poor of the flock. And I took unto me two staves, the one I called Beauty, and the other I called Bands, and I fed the flock.
Okay, so in the turmoil between the end of the Maccabean reign and the destruction of Jerusalem and the leveling of Palestine, when the Roman suppression comes in around 70 AD, there is this promise. I will feed the flock of slaughter, right? In other words, it's in this lull between the judgment beginning and actually being carried out that Christ is going to come. It's a critical point in history. And he says, I will feed. Who's saying that? The Lord my God, Christ, is the one who's saying, I will feed. He's going to take to himself the mediatorial work of the covenant. He's going to do it. And he does so, he tells us here, in order to preserve the poor, or as we can also translate the word, the humble of the flock.
Would that be the true church at that time?
Yes. So So these are the people who believe in him at that time.
The remnant. So do you believe that the remnant were privy to all this information, though the masses of the time did not know it?
This is all in the Bible. I mean, they should have known. I mean, they were in great expectation of Messiah coming, and the reason is because all of these prophecies from Daniel, from here in Zechariah, and from all over, they're all coming together. You know, it's how you can miss this is sort of mind-boggling. Right? You're only missing it because you don't want to see it, I think, if you're an impenitent Jew. Right, so the two staves, the shepherd's crooks, that were used by him to preserve his people were beauty, or as we might call it, favor, and bands, or union. And what it means is this. It's really talking about an external and an internal governance that God, that Christ has maintained over the Jews from the beginning. The Jews have been kept a distinct people and regarded by other nations sometimes with an almost superstitious regard. Right? They're very careful. You know, walk lightly around the Jews. There's something weird going on with them over there. Their God actually works for them sometimes. Okay? And this attitude, beauty, the favor that they have is maintained really until the time of the work of redemption is complete. Now, once they reject Messiah, there's no more favor. The nations no longer favor the Jews. In fact, ever since then, the nations have made up for, you know, the circumspection. Now, prior to this, the Jews did suffer, to be sure, for their disobedience. But they always maintained their nation. They always maintained a certain degree of coherence. And so they had maintained a fair degree of union within themselves until the time of the coming of Christ. At that point, you know, at the end of the Maccabean era, they start to just disintegrate from within. The internal cohesion dissolves. And the favor that they had before the nations is eroding. And so it's at this moment Messiah comes. And it's until this moment that this governance is actually succeeding until the final rejection of Messiah. So that's what's in view. He's maintained them. He's governed them. Like the same one who's come now in the flesh, he's governed them all this time. It stands for beauty and bands. Verse 8.
Three shepherds also I cut off in 1 month, and my soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me.
Yeah, three shepherds are cut off in 1 month. What does that mean? I think it's referring to the orders of the old theocracy. Prophet, priest, and king. They're brought to their fulfillment in Christ, and they're gradually dissolved. It doesn't happen all at once. Christ comes, but the end of all of this takes place over a period of about a month, prophetically, right? The prophetic month is about 30 years. And from the time that Paul goes to the Gentiles until destruction of Jerusalem is a little over 30 years. So, during the course of this time, prophet, priest, and king, all of these things have been cut off and really rooted out. And the reason is Christ is the antitype toward which the Jewish polity had looked, and with his advent and the New Testament kingdom being established, there remained no more reason for those things to continue. By the way, he goes on to say, my soul loathed them, and their soul also abhorred me. That is very clearly fulfilled, right? Christ, when he came, he denounces terrible judgments upon the Jewish leaders and those who followed them. Remember, he calls them vipers and hypocrites and whitewashed sepulchers and on and on and on. He loathes them. He has nothing. He's, you know, he despises them. Or if we take loathe in the sense, the other sense of the word here, the Hebrew word could also mean that he was straitened for them or constricted. And we see him crying over Jerusalem, 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 that killeth the prophets, right? So either way we go with this, we see both things going on. And, of course, their soul also abhorred me, you know, which is why I think that the idea of loathing is what's in view here, rather than just being straitened, because it's they also abhorred me. That is to say, the Jews are only too happy to see him crucified. You know, they prefer a common criminal over a Messiah. So you see, this is coming to pass. All right, verse 9.
Zechariah 11, verse 9. Then said I will not feed you. That that dieth, let it die. That that is to be cut off, let it be cut off. And let the rest, eat every one the flesh of another.
Okay, so this verse is really describing the effect of the final abandonment of the Jews. They wouldn't listen or be fed by him. And so, how does he respond? He's not going to feed them anymore. Now, this is the fate of all those who don't want to have Christ to rule or reign over them. So they're left to the consequences, really, of their own sin. Famine and pestilence. Right? That dieth, let it die. War. That that is to be cut off, let it be cut off. And fighting among themselves, that internal dissension. Let the rest eat every one the flesh of another. So devouring one another. And frankly, that last part during the siege of Jerusalem becomes very much a literal thing, as it had before, where they end up eating their young. All of this transpired in the latter days of the Jewish nation, and it culminated in the destruction of Jerusalem, and with it the temple. So this is really the effect of their rejection of Christ. They could have stopped it. I mean, at the moment Christ came, Zechariah is saying they're under a pendulum that if it drops, it's going to cut them in half and kill them. And here's your moment. You can be rescued, or you can continue along this path to certain condign judgment. And the vast majority of the Jewish nation say, let's keep going the way we're going. So don't be surprised, you know, when the vast majority of the American people say, let's keep going the way we're going. Right? This is human nature, fallen human nature. People are stupid in their sin. Verse 10.
Zechariah 11, verse 10. And I took my staff, even beauty, and cut it asunder, that I might break my covenant which I had made with all the people.
With all the people, or with all the Goyim, the nations. So at this time, as we approach the end of this judgment, God has removed the favor that had so long protected the nation of the Jews. He's withheld these nations from utterly destroying the nation of Israel from the time of Moses until their rejection of Christ. And he did so out of regard for his covenant with the Jews, which was like a covenant that restrained them, the nations around them, from going too far in their approaches to the people of God. And this is fulfilled eventually when the Romans surround the carcass of the Jewish commonwealth like hungry eagles, birds of prey. And you can see this if you look at Matthew 24:28. Jesus talks about this. Matthew 24:28.
Matthew 24, verse 28. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together.
Yeah, the eagles. And that's a symbol of the Romans, the eagles. Roman power. They're swift. They're birds of prey. The Romans like to go in when something's already dying. All right, verse 11.
Zechariah 10, verse 11. And it was broken in that day, and so the poor of the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord.
Yeah, the covenant was broken in that day. That is, the poor of the flock, the humble Jews that believed, they knew this was the word of the Lord. And when Jerusalem was compassed with the armies, the Christians who remembered the warning of Christ to flee to the mountains did so. And the amazing thing is, Titus, for whatever reason, and there is no explanation, he has Jerusalem under siege, and he raises the siege for just a few days. And during that time, those believing Jews who had an opportunity of obeying Christ's words were actually able to escape. They fled to Pella and escaped the fate of those who remained in the city. And this is, Christ foretold this in Luke 21, verses 20 to 22.
Luke 21, verses 20 to 22. And when ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out. And let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled.
So they knew. It was at this time. You know, they knew, they fled, and they knew that it was a word that was spoken of the Lord. Right? For the flock that waited upon me knew that it was the word of the Lord. That's when they knew, at that moment. And they fled.
A quick question for you. Is there anything, and so verse 10, just to go back to that real quick, the beauty of the Jews, does that have anything to do with the temple?
It's the word means favor. And I do think that it has to do the two things that are involved. There's an outward and an inward favor. You know, this has been taken by a number of reform guys. They refer to beauty as government and bands as discipline with regard to the church. And that's true. That's a very good application of that. So, beauty and bands. They've got a favor. They're favored people. I mean, think of all the things that we've had to note here. You know, when Alexander stops, he has that dream, right? I mean, we can go back before this time, and you see in Genesis, you know, where Abimelech has dreams, and he doesn't just kill Abraham and take his wife, right? That kind of stuff. This stuff goes way, way back. Joseph getting out of prison. These are favored people. They get raised up again and again. Esther. There's this favor that brings them up again. Why? Why does this keep happening? You know, and on the other side, there's a certain amount of internal discipline and cohesion that they've added to this. But when the covenant with God is broken, that is destroyed. You know, so they've, since then, they've tried to replace it with sort of a code of omerta. That's kind of what the Jews, how they behave now. It's like a mafioso kind of covenant. Now, they're not, you know, they've broken covenant with God. But they long for this. You know, they long for a time when they were actually favored, when people favored them. Think about how Pompey treated them. You know, he could have just killed everybody. He could have gotten there and said, hey, I don't like what I'm hearing. The Romans were known to do that kind of thing. You just didn't know how they were going to react when they got somewhere and didn't like it. But they didn't. And not only that, okay, so the Sadducees are moved out of power, but the Pharisees are moved into power. The stricter party is moved into power and end up taking care of the temple until Jesus gets there. This is a favor these people have. You know, from any way you look at it, outside looking in, it looks almost like a fluke of history again and again and again. But then after they reject Christ, the Jews have undergone pogrom after pogrom, massacre after massacre. They've been driven out of every good and decent country under heaven. Because so they've broken covenant with God.
They sort of feel the pain of being a Gentile nation after...
Sort of.
But they're also making up for lost time in a way, too.
They're trying. But they're not getting ahead. All right, now, verse 12 begins, and this is where I think it gets interesting. It begins with a record of the final rejection. So let's look at verse 12.
Zechariah 11, verse 12. And I said unto them, if you think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver.
Again, this is a reward for the travail of the soul that they give him. Now, what he should have gotten, and what he covenanted to get, that he should see the travail of the soul and be satisfied when men receive him as Savior, that's pretty clear if we look at Isaiah 53, verse 11. Isaiah 53:11.
Isaiah 53:11. He shall see of the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied by his knowledge. Shall my righteous servant justify many? For he shall bear their iniquities.
Okay, so that's what he has covenanted for that. But what do they give him? What is his price? Right? How do they view him? Christ says to the Jews, "If you think good, give me my price. That is, receive me." That's what he's saying. Instead of that, for which he had covenanted, the Jews actually gave him the price that was reserved for a servant gored by an ox. Exodus 21:32.
Exodus 21:32. If the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned.
What that represented, actually, the amount weighed out, because that's how they paid, you weighed money. It was the least amount for which someone could be valued in Jewish society. That's really what that represents. So if they could have found a smaller number than that in the law, they would have done it. But they measured out the least in their rejection of him. Right? He has given himself to see the travail of his soul, to see them come to him. And they reject him for 30 shekels of silver. And that's exactly, in fact, what's brought to pass in the actions of the arch-traitor Judas. Look at Matthew 26, verses 14 and 15. Matthew 26, verses 14 and 15.
Matthew 26, verses 14 and 15. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went unto the chief priests and said unto them, what will ye give me, and I will deliver unto you? And they
covenanted,
and with them for 30 pieces of silver.
30 pieces of silver. 30 shekels of silver. 30 weights. So again, or you see, 30 pieces of silver, not 30 shekels, 30 pieces of silver. So this comes to pass exactly, and then in verse 13,
and the Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, the goodly price that I was prized at of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord.
Okay, so the goodly price was at the command of the Lord to be cast to the potter. And now we get to what I think is an interesting allusion in Scripture. What this means is to cast it out as unholy or unclean. The potter for the temple, there was a story among the Jews that the potter for the temple had his shop set up in the Valley of Hinnom, which then in turn becomes noted because it's defiled because of the vile idolatry which was practiced there. And we see an example of this in 2 Kings 23, verse 10. 2 Kings 23, verse 10.
2 Kings 23, verse 10. Oh. And he defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the children of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or his daughter to pass through the fire to Molech.
Right. And these two thoughts of the valley of Hinnom and the potter's field are actually drawn together in Jeremiah. We're not going to read the whole chapters. We're going to look at chapters 18 and 19. I want to look at chapter 18, just verse 1, and chapter 19, just verses 1 and 2. But these are very interesting chapters because if you read them, they actually, this idea of the potter's field, the potter's house, and this field in the valley of Hinnom are drawn together. And that's important for our purposes here. So Jeremiah 18:1.
Jeremiah 18, verse 1. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying,
just in verse 2. Verses 1 and 2. Yeah.
Jeremiah 18, verses 1 and 2. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, arise, go down to the potter's house, and there I will cause thee to hear my words.
Jeremiah 19, verses 1 and 2. Thus saith the Lord God, go and get a potter's earthen bottle, and take of the ancients of the people, and the ancients of the priests, and go forth in the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is by the entry of the east gate, and proclaim there the words that I shall tell thee.
Okay, so what is going on? Jeremiah is drawing together these two thoughts, and it's really talking about the precise period of Jewish history when the city is going to be destroyed and the Jews are going to be scattered. This idea of the potter's field, the valley of Hinnom, come together. So what's going on here is this. Zechariah mentions the potter in here, in this section, to connect this prophecy to the older one of Jeremiah in order to show it's only a fuller development of it, which now contains a second and wider execution of the threatening that was therein contained against unfaithfulness. Jeremiah is talking about the Babylonian captivity, but Zechariah is looking forward to this dispersion, a different kind of dispersion at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. He's widening that. And that's why it's quoted in this manner by Matthew as being from Jeremiah. Look at Matthew 27, verse 9.
Matthew 27, verse 9. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremy the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was valued, whom they of the children of Israel did value.
Matthew does that because ultimately he's referencing what Zechariah is referencing. And so he knows that Zechariah is referencing Jeremiah. And by mentioning Jeremiah, he's drawing you through Zechariah. He's drawing Jeremiah through Zechariah, but he's going back to the source. It's like difference between quoting someone directly and quoting them in a secondary source. Right? Matthew's going back to the primary source so that you can draw your secondary conclusion from it and through it. It's not a mistake. This is done elsewhere in the Bible. Mark does it at the beginning of his gospel when he refers to, I believe it's Isaiah and the prophets, and he's quoting and he's drawing out implications that are actually found across a spectrum. You go back and you grab the first person who's using these kinds of allusions. All right, verse 14.
Zechariah 11, verse 14. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel.
Yeah, so far from regaining unity after the Jews reject Christ, they're plagued with internal dissension, the destruction of the brotherhood. And really, this is the true story. You know, the breach that erupts after they reject Christ, that finally brings them to a point where they're so weakened by it that they're open and ripe for destruction, that breach was like the breach between Judah and Israel, which, remember, remained unhealed. That breach had resulted ultimately in the demise of the northern kingdom. This breach is going to signal the demise of the southern kingdom, Judah, the Jews. As the time of the Roman destruction approached, the Jews are already engaged in the most terrible fratricides within. And this is a matter of record. Josephus records it. It's out there. The Romans, again, simply do what Romans did best. They profited from the situation. They profited from the strife, and they brought the punishment of the full penalty of the broken covenant upon the unbelieving Jews. So they move in on a people that aren't even able to keep themselves together. And they bring total and final destruction. Verse 15.
Zechariah 11:15, And the Lord said unto me, Take unto thee yet the instruments of a foolish shepherd.
Right, so again, the Lord speaks to the prophet and tells him to resume taking up instruments to represent the actions of God toward his people. Now, what's interesting here is that, you know, a people who are cast off are not people without a shepherd. No, the fact is they take to themselves foolish shepherds. So when the Jews are cut off, when they've been dispossessed of the land, does that make them return to Christ? No. No, they're going to take to themselves foolish shepherds. And that's what these various instruments, accompanying items, or things that belong to shepherds is like. Foolish shepherds, they think they're shepherds because they have outward things that a shepherd uses. That doesn't make them a shepherd. You know, it doesn't make you a shepherd because you can wear a shepherd's robe and carry a shepherd's crook and all of that. It doesn't make you a shepherd. But these are foolish shepherds. And what this means is the Jews are going to continue to don sort of the outward garb of the Mosaic Covenant, even though it's been broken. They're going to hold on to that. Verse 16.
Verse 16. Below, I will raise up a shepherd in the land, which shall not visit those that be cut off, neither shall seek the young one, nor heal that is broken, nor feed that stands still, but he shall eat the flesh of the fat and tear their claws in pieces.
Okay, so the judgment is still upon them. There's going to be a false shepherd established among the Jews, centered in their land. But this shepherd doesn't do what's proper to a shepherd. Doesn't care for the sheep. He makes them the source of greedy gain. And look at the characteristics of the false shepherd. Neglect, greed, cruelty. It's greedy, cruel, and neglectful of them. And that's exactly what happens with the rise of Talmudic Judaism. And Talmudic Judaism is, in its own right, foreshadowing the rise of Romanism. You know, when the glory departs from the church, when the institution remains, but the spirit is gone. It's a foolish shepherd. And both of these, what they have in common is this. These false shepherds are going to be cut off. As we're going to see in verse 17, they have to be cut off before there can be a restoration of the people of God. So look at verse 17.
Verse 17. Woe to the idle shepherd that leaveth the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right eye. His arm shall be clean, dried up. His right eye shall be utterly darkened.
So this is the fate of all idle shepherds, all false teachers, false churches. And in the end, God's instruments of judgment are themselves reserved to judgment. So Talmudic Judaism is a judgment on the unbelieving Jews. Romanism is a judgment upon the unbelieving papists. Right, these are judgments. But in the end, these things are going to be removed. And that brings us really to chapter 12. And chapter 12 is going to bring us to that point where we're going to look at the restoration of the Jews. But this tells us that during this time, when they're cast off, when they're cut off from the covenant of God, they're going to be under the power of foolish shepherds. And the same applies to Christendom. Outward institutions avail nothing if there's no inward spirit. It's just foolish shepherding. And so next time, we'll continue with chapter 12.